Thank you very much, Richard. Can you all hear me? Okay. Well, it's a great pleasure to be in London at the London School of Economics. I'm still sort of pinching myself, wondering what I'm doing in a place like this, but I won't question it. Yes. If you've been looking at this image on the screen above you, you sort of know where I'm going to begin. In fact, I'm sure there are people here who know this scene by heart. For those of you who don't, just remember, this is from Annie Hall. And I think of it as my starting point, where I started to think about media and think about how not to think about media. As you remember, Woody Allen is stuck on a movie line next to an obnoxious media studies professor from Columbia University who insists on broadcasting his stupid opinions about cinema. When the professor starts to hold forth on McLuhan's theories of media, Woody can stand it no longer. He steps out of the line and addresses the camera and the moviegoer directly, complaining about being trapped next to this boor. The professor then steps toward the camera as well and responds, "Hey, it's a free country. Don't I have a right to my opinions too?" When he goes on to defend his own credentials to explain McLuhan, Woody has his moment of triumph. He says, "Oh yeah, well I have Marshall McLuhan right here." McLuhan steps into view and squelches the obnoxious professor with a decisive put down. "I heard what you were saying. You know nothing about my theories." Woody smiles at the camera and sighs, "If only life were like that." What I want to suggest is, if only movies were like that. I imagine that most of you remember all of this, but I would be surprised if you remember exactly what McLuhan says. And that's why I want to play this for you. And I want you to notice that there is a little problem with your memory of this scene. And that there's a tiny glitch has been introduced into the dialogue, in particularly the lines spoken by the authority figure, the media oracle, the one who is supposed to know, namely Marshall McLuhan himself. So let's listen carefully and see if you know what, notice what I'm talking about.
You know what a sequel to Turn of the Screw?
It's the influence of television.
Yeah, now Marshall McLuhan deals with it in terms of it being a high intensity, you understand, a hot medium.
What I would give for a large sock
as
with horse manure in it. What do you do when you get stuck on a movie line with a guy like this behind you?
Wait a minute, why can't
it's
I
just
get my opinion? It's a free country?
He can give you. You have to give it so loud. I mean, aren't you ashamed to pontificate like that? And the funny part of it is, Marshall McLuhan, you don't know anything about Marshall McLuhan's work.
Really? I happen to teach a class at Columbia called TV, Media, and Culture. So I think that my insights into Mr. McLuhan will have a great deal of validity.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Well, that's funny because I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here. So yeah, just let me come over here a second.
Oh, I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. You mean my whole fallacy is wrong. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Boy, if life were only like this.
Now, did you all hear what I'm talking about? It's a moment when McLuhan says, "You know nothing about my theories. Why, you mean my entire fallacy is wrong." I played this over and over again because I couldn't, you know, what kind of nonsense is going on here? There must be a mistake in the script, or perhaps in McLuhan's delivery of his lines. He should have said, "You mean my entire theory is wrong, or my hypothesis is wrong." But he says, "You mean my entire fallacy is wrong." But of course his fallacy is wrong. That's what it means to be a fallacy. So why should McLuhan, as he steps forward to declare his authority as the oracle of media theory, a kind of medium in his own right, subvert his authority by calling his theory a fallacy? At the very least, it suggests that one had better approach the question of media somewhat cautiously. If even the inventor of media studies, the great avatar of media theory, who became a media star in his own right, is capable of slipping on a banana in his scene of triumph, what lies in wait for the rest of us who think we have a right to our opinions about media? How can we hope, as McLuhan promised, to understand media, much less to become experts about them? Perhaps we need a less ambitious model than understanding. That's what I propose to explore by addressing media. not as if they were logical systems or structures, but as if they were environments where images live, or personas and avatars that address us and can be addressed in turn. And I should mention, this is part of a larger project about called What Do Pictures Want? Subtitled The Lives and Loves of Images. I want to suggest that this is the moment when I turn from the loves of images and their life forms to some reckoning with the media in which they appear. The difference between an image and a picture, for instance, is precisely a question of the medium. An image can only appear in some medium or other, in paint, stone, words, numbers. But what about media? How do they appear? How do they make themselves manifest and understandable? It's tempting, of course, to settle on a rigorously materialist answer to this question and to identify the medium as simply the material support in which the image appears. But this answer seems unsatisfactory on the face of it. A medium is more than the materials of which it's composed, and of course, materials are more than the materials of which they're composed. I think any sculptor will tell you that the materiality of the medium is a complex set of substances that come from some place, have names and histories of human use that defy simple reduction to essential categories. So even to name the medium of gold or brass or steel is already to be involved in something more than just the name of a simple substance. Beyond that, Raymond Williams, I think, wisely insisted that a medium is a material social practice, a set of skills, habits, techniques, tools, codes, and conventions. Williams, I think, unfortunately wanted to push this insight to the point of jettisoning the whole idea of media as an unnecessary reification in itself. The title of his classic essay on this subject, From Medium to Social Practice, suggests as much. Williams' idea was to release the study of media from a misplaced emphasis on the material support and move it toward a description of the social practices that constitute it. But perhaps this gesture of demystification goes too far. Is, for instance, every social practice a medium? This is not the same, by the way, as asking whether every social practice is mediated. Is a tea party, a union walkout, an election, a bowling league, a playground game, a war, a negotiated settlement, a medium? Surely they're all social practices, but it would seem odd to call them media, no matter how much they might depend upon media of various sorts. So the concept of a medium, if it's worth preserving at all, seems, perhaps unsurprisingly, to occupy a middle ground between materials and the things people do with them. Williams' phrase, material social practice, I think was an attempt to sketch this middle ground in contrast to the thrust of his argument, which wants to move us from one side, from materials to social practice, from media to social practice. Perhaps this is the fundamental paradox built into the concept of media as such. A media just is a middle, an in-between or go-between, a space or pathway or messenger that connects two things, a sender to a receiver, writer to reader, artist to a beholder, or in the case of the spiritualist sense of media, this world to the next world. The problem arises when we try to determine the boundaries of the medium. Defined narrowly, confined to the space or figure of mediation, we're returned to the reified picture of materials, tools, supports, and so forth. Defined more broadly as a social practice, the medium of writing, for instance, clearly includes the writer and the reader. The medium of painting includes the painter and the beholder, and perhaps the collector, the gallery, and the museum as well. So if media are middles, they are like accordions, ever-elastic middles, that expand to include what at first look like their outer boundaries. So here I show you a painting in the Art Institute of Chicago. But actually, what I'm really showing you is not a painting in the Art Institute of Chicago, but a photograph in the Art Institute of Chicago by the German photographer Thomas Struth, which is called A Rainy Day at the Art Institute. So that is the work of art that I'm reproducing here. And then I went to the Art Institute one afternoon when it was displayed and took a picture of Thomas Strutt's Rainy Day at the Art Institute with a spectator looking at his photograph. So this is what I think of as my mnemonic device for reminding you of that ever-elastic middle, that expanding series of frames. The medium doesn't lie between sender and receiver. It includes and constitutes them. So a question arises. Are we left with that familiar trap, the vortex, the mise en abîme, a version of the Derridean maxim about texts, so that there's nothing outside the medium? What does it mean to go to the movies? When are we inside or outside the medium? Is it when we're in the theater, or like Woody Allen in Annie Hall, standing online in the lobby? Let's think of this as the statement that goes with these questions. The vagueness built into the concept of media is one of the main stumbling blocks in the way of a systematic discipline of media studies, which seems today to occupy a peculiar position, at least in the humanities in America, which is all I can speak about with any real knowledge. One of the youngest emergent disciplines in the study of culture and society, it exists in a parasitical relation to departments of rhetoric and communication, to film studies, cultural studies, literature, and the visual arts. The common rubrics these days are cinema and media studies, as at my university, or as if the general idea of media was a supplement to the centrally located medium of film, or communication and media studies, as if media were instrumental technologies in the master domain of communicating messages. In the field of art history, with its obsession over the materiality and specificity of media, the supposedly dematerialized realm of virtual and digital media, as well as the whole sphere of mass media, are commonly seen as beyond the pale of art history proper, or as a threatening invader gathering at the gates of the aesthetic and artistic citadel. A symptom of art history's ambivalent relation to media is the way it marginalizes architecture as, at best, the third most important medium in its purview, well down the standard hierarchy that places painting at the top, sculpture a distant second, while the oldest, most pervasive medium that human beings have devised, the art of constructing spaces, languishes at the bottom of the art historical tree. I know that I'm very well aware that architecture has its own places, but I'm talking about within the discipline of art history. In the study of literature, my home discipline, the medium of language and the specific technologies of writing, from the invention of the printing press to the typewriter to the computer, are relatively minor issues, in my view, compared to questions of genre, form, and style, which are generally studied independently of the specific material vehicle through which literary works are transmitted. So this, I'm sure, will get an argument. People would say, structuralism and post-structuralism, what were they about, if not about the medium of language? But we can get to a full-scale argument about that later. 30 years after the death of Marshall McLuhan, the pioneer of media studies, the field then still doesn't have its own identity. Symptomatic of this is the need to constantly overturn McLuhan, to recite all his mistakes and fallacies, and bemoan his naive predictions of the end of labor, the emergence of the global village, and the development of a new planetary consciousness, a kind of wired world spirit, which survives, I think, today in Wired magazine. Contemporary media theory, as if in reaction against McLuhan's rather cheery optimism, is driven by an obsession with war machines, as in the work of Friedrich Kittler and Paul Virilio, and traces every technical innovation in media to the arts of coercion, aggression, and destruction, surveillance and propaganda spectacle. Or it's often involved in a presentist rhetoric that takes the internet and the age of digital information as the horizon of its interests. Or it focuses exclusively on the mass media, television and print journalism, as a uniquely modern invention that can be rigorously distinguished from traditional media, old media. Perhaps the most interesting symptom in the current discussion is a recurrent theme of the end of media themselves, and the death of media studies, of course, along with it. A claim which, if true, would make this one of the shortest-lived concepts in the history of human thought. Just 30 years ago, in the wake of McLuhan's meteoric career and burnout as a has-been media star in his own right, Jean Baudrillard penned a famous essay entitled Requiem for the Media, in which he denounced Hans Magnus Enzensberger's hopeful attempts to sketch out a socialist theory of media in terms of productive forces and a consciousness industry. There is no theory of the media, declared Baudrillard, his opening sentence, except empiricism and mysticism. The listing of media effects, types, and a kind of mystical sense that the media are everywhere. He also dismissed the idea that socialism could somehow harness the productive forces of the intransitive, non-reciprocal structures of mass media. This was dismissed as a pipe dream harnessed to an illusion. Even Friedrich Kittler, who opens his classic book, Gramophone Film Typewriter, by declaring that media determine our situation, within a few pages is hinting that the age of media, the era of the great media inventions, cinema, sound recording, and the keyboard interface, may now be over. The invention of the computer, Kittler says, promises a total media link on a digital base enabled by fiber optic technologies that will, and I quote, erase the very concept of medium. Instead of wiring people and technologies, absolute knowledge will run in an endless loop. All that is left for the present, according to Kittler, is entertainment, as we wait for the arrival of the endless loop that will not include any human component in its circuits. So if Kittler is right, we're just at the threshold of the end of the age of media, and cinema, the gramophone, and the typewriter, the keyboard, those were the great inventions, and they've now all been assimilated into this master technology, which will not be any medium. It will be a meta-medium that goes well beyond any of those. So what does it mean to address media today at the threshold of the 21st century? I raise this question in contrast to McLuhan's notion of understanding in order to foreground the way media address or call out to us and the ways in which we imagine ourselves talking back to or addressing media. And the primal scene of this address, I suppose one would be the scene from Annie Hall we just saw, but the more familiar one is the one at my dinner table every night when we find ourselves shouting at the television set, putting our hands on the radio, trying to strangle the media avatar who is telling us the latest news about the U.S.'s relentless march toward war. How are the media addressing us? Who is the us they are addressing? And what is the address of media in the sense of their location or place in social and mental life? Or to quote a line which you will hear at the end of this talk in my final film clip, who's behind it? What do they want? How in particular can we address the totality of media, not just the mass or technical media, not just television and print, but obsolete and archaic media, and media in McLuhan's expanded field, money, exchange, clothing, communication systems, transportation, political institutions, and so forth. One avenue is offered, and I'm talking about how do you think about the totality now, not any particular medium, but how could you think media? The most systematic attempt to do this, I think, is offered by systems theory and by Nicholas Luhmann, who basically reduces the world to the moment of differentiation between system and environment. Systems as autopoietic, semi-autonomous entities, and he extends this to mean biological organisms as well in their environments, and then the environment which supports either the system or the organism. This basic abstract structure for systems turns out to be a nest of Chinese boxes in which systems, such as minds and organisms, never communicate with one another. One of Luhmann's fundamental postulates is minds do not communicate, only communication communicates. And he says anyone who thinks about this for 5 minutes will realize that no mind has ever communicated with any other mind. Absolutely impossible. So what can minds do and what can systems do? Well, they can manage to observe their own observing. That's Luhmann's conclusion. The ultimate result of systems theory seems to be, finally, a kind of Hegelian version of Baudrillard's feared mystical empiricism. Worked out with impeccable logic, finding that systems or like organisms, while environments seen from a high enough level can begin to look like systems or organisms themselves. So you get the nested Chinese box system of system environment going all the way down or all the way up. Media can fit on both sides. Sorry, this is so loud. But media can fit on both sides of the system-environment divide. They're a system for transmitting messages through a material vehicle to a receiver, or they are a space in which forms can thrive. In vernacular reflections on media, we describe this as the difference between a medium through which messages are transmitted and a medium in which forms and images appear. And let me just, I gotta apologize, this is gonna be a noisy diagram, but. Luhmann points out that this distinction between the form and the medium is really the same as the old, or is mapped onto the old distinction between the orderly and the chaotic, and that the medium is a kind of chaos of possibilities, of unbound elements. He calls the loose coupling of elements like an alphabet, and the tight coupling of elements like a paragraph or a poem. Forms within media are assertive, they declare themselves, whereas media offer no resistance. They are simply there in the background. I apologize to Nicholas Luhmann, the late Nicholas Luhmann, and to you for giving you a kind of pop-up theory encapsulation of the systems approach, but I want to cover some other things besides this. So. That is one way of systematizing this problem. The other famous one is, of course, the communication model. And in vernacular terms, we might describe the difference between what Luhmann shows us and what, say, Umberto Eco shows us in this diagram, is the difference between a medium through which messages are transmitted from a sender to a receiver by means of a code, through a channel or apparatus with some interference along the way. Think of these as the medium in which forms appear on the one side and the medium through which messages are transmitted on the other. I think those a lot of media theory basically comes down to those two fundamental models. What do we do to try to make a move beyond this? If we're stuck with mystical empiricism, and I think, you know, in a way Baudrillard was right, but we have to recuperate both words, both empiricism and the notion that media, there's something unavoidably ghostly, phantasmatic, and perhaps mystical about them. But if we're going to do that, accept that limitation, then I want my theory to be as concrete as possible. And so I want to, instead of using the system environment dialectic as the master term, I want to suggest we think of media in terms of faces and places, or figures and spaces. If we're going to address media, not just study or reflect on them, we need to transform them into something that can be addressed, which we already do when we yell at the television set, something that can be greeted and challenged or hailed. If we're going to address media in the other sense, that is, locate them, give them an address, then the challenge is to place them and to see them as landscapes or spaces. This may all finally correspond to that distinction between system and environment, but it'll have the advantage of being more picturesque and concrete. The methodological strategy that I'm following here is what I've called picturing theory. That is, treating theory as an embodied discourse, one that's constructed around critical metaphors, analogies, models, figures, cases, scenes, and above all, around works of art. A theory of media that follows this path has to ask not only what media are, what they do, it has to raise the question of what the medium of theory itself might be. We tend to assume that some form of critical or philosophical language, the meta-language of systems theory or semiotics, for instance, might lift us out of media and give us a scientific perspective on their totality. My approach is just the opposite. It assumes that no theory of media can rise above the media themselves. and what's required are forms of vernacular theory embedded in media practices. These will turn out to be what I've called meta-pictures, media objects that reflect on their own constitution. Or to recall Robert Morris's wonderful object of minimalist Dadaism, boxes with the sound of their own making. So in the remainder of this talk, I want to articulate the principles that I think follow from the effort to address media concretely rather than to understand them abstractly through the metapictures that give them faces and locate them in places. And there'll be this is basically going to be 10 sort of propositions or theses. First, when I address the question of media, I think it's important not to confine ourselves exclusively or even primarily to the modern sphere of mass media or technical, mechanical, or electronic media. I prefer to see the modern and traditional and so-called primitive media as dialectically and historically linked. Ancient and archaic media such as painting, sculpture, and architecture provide a framework for the understanding of television, cinema, and the internet. At the same time that our view of these earlier media and even our understanding of them as media in the first place depends always on the invention of new means of communication, simulation, and representation. So is this television? Is this sculpture? Is it television enframed inside of sculpture? Is it a new figure of sovereignty, a new Leviathan? And if it is, does television make up a linked element within it, within a new avatar or human body with its scepter and crown? Nam June Paik, I think, gives us a way of making the Lumanian questions, these Chinese boxes, suddenly vivid and concrete. Ancient practices, which survive today in 2003, such as body painting, scarification, gesture language, all these survive, albeit in new forms, in contemporary media. And many of the anxieties surrounding traditional media involve questions of technical innovation, from the proliferation of graven images to the invention of writing. And this is a sidebar to this. I think if you believe that the notion of the digitized image was invented along with the computer, you should spend some time contemplating the oldest unbroken painting tradition on the planet, namely that of Aboriginal painting, which uses the dot and bar, the zero and the one, in the most vivid and complex ways. Second principle, insofar as there is a history of media, it's not usefully, I think, bifurcated between modern and traditional forms. A dialectical account of media involves the recognition of uneven development, of the survival of traditional media in the modern world, and anticipations of new media in ancient practices. The first medium, architecture, Walter Benjamin noted long ago, has always been a mass medium, at least in the sense that it's consumed, as he says, in a state of distraction. The movies did not invent distraction. Mass media did not invent distraction. Outdoor sculpture has addressed and represented mass collectivities since time immemorial. Television may be a mass medium, but its point of address is generally in the private domestic space, not a mass gathering. And technology has always played a role in the production of works of art and the communication of messages over distance, from the invention of fire to the drum to metallurgy to the printing press. The notion of new media, the internet, the computer, video, virtual reality, must be tempered then by the recognition that media are always new and have always been sites of technical innovation. And just to recall the chestnut example, which I think should be required reading for every media studies scholar, Plato regarded writing as a dangerous innovation, an invention that would destroy the older medium of human memory and the dialectical resources of face-to-face conversation. Baudelaire thought that the invention of photography would destroy painting. The printing press has been blamed for revolution and youthful violence has been attributed to everything from video games to comic books. So when it comes to media, the shock of the new is as old as the hills and needs to be kept in perspective. There has always been a shock of the new with media. They have always been associated with divine invention, with double-edged gifts from the gods. that is, the voice of God himself inscribed in alphabetic writing, or false idols that represent God in the wrong way. They're also invariably associated with legendary creators and messengers. Thuth, the inventor of writing, Moses, the bringer of the phonetic alphabet from Sinai, Edison and the gramophone, Remington and the typewriter, Prometheus and the fire, and McLuhan, the Promethean inventor of media studies as such. That doesn't mean that these innovations are not really new, and I wouldn't want you to misunderstand me here. I'm not saying, when I say it's old as the hills, I'm saying innovation is as old as the hills. But that doesn't mean that every innovation does the same thing or counts for the same thing. All it means is that if we want to write a history of media, we mustn't think that we have crossed some great divide between the old and the new in the last 10 years, and that that is the really important one. Many, many great divides have been crossed, and they all have to be taken seriously by this field. In this image of Poussin, where is the new medium? Is it in the alphabetic writing of the law that Moses brings from Mount Sinai, or the new technology of sculptural casting that Aaron forges as a spectacular substitute for the invisible God? In their way, each of them is a new medium, and they're fighting it out to see which one will be dominant. Third principle, the notion of media is derivative of a more embracing concept of mediation and goes well beyond the materials and technologies of art and mass media to include such arenas as political mediations, logical media, as in the middle term of a syllogism, economic mediations, money and commodities, and biological media, as in the biotic culture or habitat, the environment-organism relation that Luhmann works with. And finally, unavoidably, I want to suggest, spiritual mediations, the medium as the go-between at a seance, the idol as symbol of an invisible spiritual presence. A medium, in short, is not just a set of materials, an apparatus, or a code that mediates between individuals, but a complex social institution that contains individuals inside of it and is constituted by a history of practices, rituals, and habits, skills and techniques, as well as by a set of material objects. So a medium is as much a guild, a profession, a conglomerate, or a corporate entity as it is a material means for communicating. This proposition leads us back, however, to the Pandora's box opened by Raymond Williams' concept of social practice, threatening to unleash a boundless concept of media. So we need to supplement this principle with yet another maxim, in this case illustrated by the following cartoon from The New Yorker. The principle I want to suggest is that there is always something outside a medium. Every medium constructs a corresponding zone of immediacy, of the unmediated and transparent, which stands in contrast to the medium itself. That moment in Woody Allen's film, I suppose, is the moment when Woody addresses immediately the beholder of the film. That counts as a kind of immediacy in contrast to what has preceded it. The window was, of course, a medium in its own right, dependent on the emergence of suitable technologies of glass rolling. Windows are perhaps one of the most important inventions in the history of visual culture, opening architecture to new relations of inner and outer, and remapping the human body by analogy into inner and outer spaces, making it possible to think of the eyes as the windows of the soul. From the grillwork of Islamic ornament to the stained glass windows of medieval Europe, to the show windows and arcades of modern shopping and flânerie, to the windows of Microsoft, the window is anything, as Anne Friedberg has showed, but a transparent, self-evident, or unmediated entity. But this cartoon also reminds us that the new medium is paradoxically often associated with immediacy and the unmediated, so that high-definition, high-speed computing makes it possible to simulate the older medium of the transparent window perfectly. In this sense, new media don't, as is often said, remap our senses so much as they analyze the operations of the senses as they are already constructed by nature and by habit and by previous media, and try to simulate the older media. Fourth principle, all media are mixed media. There are no pure media, although pure painting, sculpture, architecture, and so forth are involved in the search for the essence of a medium, what Clement Greenberg saw as the task of the modernist avant-garde. I think this is a utopian gesture that seems inseparable from the artistic deployment of any medium. The issue of media purity and specificity arises when a medium becomes self-referential and renounces its function as a means of communication. At this point, certain exemplary images of the medium become canonized, abstract painting most notably, as embodying the inner essence of the medium as such. Fifth principle, mental life, memory, imagination, fantasy, dreaming, is mediated and is embodied in the whole range of material media. Thinking does not, as Wittgenstein famously put it, reside in some queer medium inside the head. We think out loud, at the keyboard, with tools and images and sounds. And this process is thoroughly reciprocal. Saul Steinberg calls drawing thinking on paper. But thinking can also be a kind of drawing, a mental sketching, or in my own case, aimless scribbling. We not only think about media, then we think in them, which is why they give us the headache endemic to recursive thinking. And this is why I think there is no privileged meta-language of media in semiotics, linguistics, or discourse analysis. Our relation to media is one of mutual and reciprocal constitution. We create them, and they create us. That's why so many creation myths describe the deity as an artificer working in various media to make an ensemble of creations, the architecture of the universe, the sculpted forms of animals and human beings, who then go on to invent new media themselves. Sixth principle, if we wish to address media as such, we must recognize that images, not language, are their main currency. Speech and writing are, of course, crucial to articulating and deciphering the messages conveyed by media. But the medium itself is the embodied messenger, not the message. McLuhan, I think, got it right on his second try, the one usually dismissed as idiocy, when he said, the medium is the massage, not the message. Speech and writing, moreover, are themselves simply two kinds of media, the one embodied in acoustic images, the other in graphic images. Seventh, images reside within media, the way organisms reside within a habitat. Like organisms, they can move from one media environment to another, so that a verbal image can be reborn in a painting or a photograph, and a sculpted image can be rendered in cinema or virtual reality. This is why one medium can be nested inside another, and why a medium can seem to become visible in a canonical exemplar, as when, say, Rembrandt comes to stand for oil painting, or oil painting comes to stand for painting, or painting comes to stand in art history for fine art. It's also, I think, why the notion of a life of images is so inevitable. Images need a place to live, and that's what a medium provides. McLuhan argued famously that the content of a medium is always another medium. Where he went wrong, I think, was in assuming that the other medium had to be an earlier medium. Novels and plays as the content of film, film as the content of video and television. The fact is that a newer and even a non-existent medium, one that has not yet been invented, may be nested inside of an older medium, most notably in the plethora of science fiction films today that predict technological breakthroughs in imaging and communication, in virtual reality environments, teleportation devices, or brain implants that have yet to be invented. So there are new media, yet to exist new media around us, and they are nested inside of very familiar and old ones, especially, I think, in cinema. New media inventions invariably produce a set of hypothetical futures along with them, both utopian and dystopian, as Plato saw when he predicted that writing would destroy human memory. Eighth principle, the notion of addressing media, all of them as a general field, is a thoroughly mythical and paradoxical concept. The media, in some strict sense, have no address and cannot be addressed. Like the god of monotheism, like the matrix of modern sci-fi, which I show you here, the moment in the matrix when Neo, the chosen one, sees through the veil of analog representation to the digital understructure of alphanumeric ciphers flowing through cyberspace. Like the matrix of modern sci-fi, the media are everywhere and nowhere, singular and plural. Hitler's claim then that media determine our situation, the first sentence of his book, I think needs to be revised to say something like, media are our situation. They are that in which we live and move and have our being. They're not located in a particular place or thing, but are themselves the space in which messages and representations thrive and circulate. So asking for the address of a medium is like asking for the address of the postal system. There may be specific post offices, but the medium known as the postal service does not have an address. It contains addresses within itself. It is what makes addresses possible. So, ninth, we cannot address media or be addressed by media as such. We address and are addressed by images of media, stereotypes of specific mediascapes, or personifying figures, media stars, moguls, gurus, oracles, and what we call the media spokesperson, the press agent. When we speak of being hailed or interpolated by media, then we are implicitly projecting a personification of the media, addressing it as a speaker for whom we are the addressee. And that's why I think the address of media takes two distinct forms, one figural, the other spatial. The address is that of a speaking subject to an addressee, in which case the medium often takes on a face and body, represented in an avatar, as when the Matrix speaks through its agents and the hackers respond. Or second, the address as a location, a place, a site, in which case the important thing is where the address is coming from, as we say. Tenth, given that media address us with and as images of spaces or bodies, landscapes or figures, they produce in us all the ambivalence we associate with images. They are the invisible matrix or the hyper-visible spectacle, the hidden God or his incarnate living word made flesh or made into a spectacular idol. They are mere instruments of our will, increasingly perfect means of communicative action, or out-of-control machines that are leading us to slavery and extinction. And I should say and or in each of these cases. So I conclude that a reasonable place to start addressing media is where I began, by addressing images of media, the forms they bring to life and that bring them to life. But to illustrate this point, I want to end with a meditation on a scene from David Cronenberg's horror classic, Videodrome, in which a trio of what I've been calling media avatars are brought together in the same space. And the whole distinction between the medium as body and space is deconstructed. And just to remind you of the scene I'm going to show you, Max Wren, who is the avatar of television production, he is the producer of a Toronto kind of minor television station, played by James Woods. He's been searching for a tough new form of pornography to circulate because the ratings are down. And he has been having problems. He's been having strange experiences, hallucinations. But he's been given a video cassette of a lecture by a famous media theorist named Dr. Brian Oblivion. This film was made not too long after McLuhan's death, and I think Cronenberg is clearly involved in an homage to McLuhan, and that Brian Oblivion represents the dead McLuhan. And we've already met Brian Oblivion several times in this film as an enigmatic oracle who declines all invitations to appear in person on live television, insisting that, he says, I only appear on television. So earlier we've seen him in a video monitor in an uncanny scene where he's being questioned by the talk show host, and he seems to sort of hear what she's saying. And of course, as always, he doesn't respond by answering her questions. He just goes on with his rap about television screen becoming, as McLuhan would say, the retina of the mind's eye. I mean, his philosophy is pure McLuhan. And the third figure is a gorgeous television personality named Nikki Brand, who has been having an affair with the television producer, Max Wren. Let's have a look. Oh, terrible. Oh, that spoiled everything.
The The battle for the mind of North America will be fought in the video arena, the video drum. The television screen is the retina of the mind's eye. Therefore, the television screen is part of the physical structure of the brain. Therefore, whatever appears on the television screen emerges as raw experience for those who watch it. Therefore, television is reality, and reality is less than television.
Max, I'm so glad you came to me. I've been through it all myself, you see. Your reality is already half video hallucination. If you're not careful, it will become total hallucination. You'll have to learn to live in a very strange new world. I had a brain tumor, and I had visions. I believe the visions caused the tumor and not the reverse. I could feel the visions coalesce and become flesh. Uncontrollable flesh. But when they removed the tumor, it was called Videodrome. I was the I was Videodrome's first victim.
But who's behind it?
For the mind of North America
should never touch your machines.
The video arena, the video drum. The television screen is the retina of the mind's eye. Therefore, the television screen is part of the physical structure of the brain.
I'm sorry, I'm just screwed this up. I'm just going to tell you about the end of the scene. As Max asked the question, the $64 question about media, but who's behind it? What do they want? The executioner pulls off her hood and reveals herself to be Nikki Brand, his lover, who says, "I want you, Max." When he pulls back, she says, "Come to Nikki. I want you." And the TV set begins to come alive. Her lips fill the screen. And finally, Max plunges his face and head into her waiting mouth as the television screen becomes this devouring kind of entity. All of the supposedly stable components of the medium, sender, receiver, apparatus, code, and embodied message are rewired in this scene. The producer is consumed. The embodied image that should be the consumed object of visual pleasure turns out to be the consumer. The mechanical apparatus becomes a living organism that breathes and purrs with lust. And the media theorist, the oracle of the code who should stand outside media in Olympian serenity, is, as Brian Oblivion says, its first victim. We can read this, of course, as an allegory of the death of McLuhan himself, the great avatar of media theory brought down by the curse of his own media celebrity. As McLuhan became a bigger media star, appearing on the Dick Cavett Show, Laugh-In, Annie Hall, and consulting with American corporations about new product lines, his academic reputation hit the skids. He was quickly supplanted by a new media oracle in the early 1980s, the rising star of the safely posthumous and more politically correct Walter Benjamin. That's another story, the story of media theory. But I think there's a more fundamental lesson to be learned from this scene, and that's the presence of media theory in the midst of the media. Of course, these theories need to be greeted and transcoded with all the tools of semiotics and hermeneutics. But this cannot happen as long as we imagine that the media are somehow an object for scrutiny by master discourses of theory. Perhaps we need a new label for this pursuit, a medium theory that would acknowledge its middling and muddling location in the midst of media. This would be the location of theory as an immanent vernacular, closely tied to practice while reflecting on it from within. It would ask the question of media, who's behind it? What do they want? Without expecting the answer to be as simple as Rupert Murdoch, dummy, or as indeterminate as a mystical notion of the mass media system as a massive living totality, the paranoid scenario of the Matrix, or the autopoietic system environment shuffle of Niklas Luhmann. The answer to who's behind it may also be ourselves and our obscure objects of desire, the fantasy of fatal pleasure personified by Nikki Brand. As for what the media want, that much is clear. And let's hope I can get this to work. They want you. As my final image suggests, the nation, in the form of its media avatar, Uncle Sam, declares this message in no uncertain terms. But hidden within the message of the national demand is a latent counter-desire that reveals the archenemy himself, nested inside our fantasy of national unity, interest, and heroic self-sacrifice. That seems like the appropriate place to conclude this address to media. Thanks very much.
I'm Nick Caudry from the media faculty here. I just want to go back to Baudrillard and his wonderful essay, Requiem for the Media, which you mentioned. And although he starts an essay saying there is no theory of media, he actually then later offers a theory of media, which is to say that the most important thing about media is the way they divide the world up into the people who produce and the people who consume. Those who tend to be on one side, close to what is quite a small industry, and those who are on the other side, the audiences who see themselves as forever in the position of just consumers. And I'd suggest that's quite a significant social division. So that brings back the issue of power. And I wonder how, in opening up the notion of medium mediation in the wonderful way that you did, you can find a way of inserting back the question of power, that obviously is suggested by some of your last images, because it's clearly quite crucial to understanding what's going on in terms of the representations of the political possibilities open to us.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think you're absolutely right. Baudrillard does go on to make that that rather sharp distinction. I think the problem with, if that's a theory, he doesn't say that it is, but Baudrillard then goes on to say that the redemptive moment in the opposing power is to confront the new technical mass media, which are intransitive, with older media, to destroy the transmitters. I mean, at that phase in his career, he was advocating a kind of Luddite situationism. And he talked about the posters and the graffiti and the witticisms on the streets of Paris in 68 as the alternative to media. The students made a basic mistake. Shouldn't have tried to seize the transmitters. I think Baudrillard basically is recapitulating Plato's theory of media, that you've got to get outside of media. And to that extent, I think he's being quite utopian. He's being a good situationist there. And I think the move makes tactical sense for that moment of 68. But it doesn't seem to me adequate today for either a tactics or a theory of media. Though the opposing power to media, well, I think some lessons are still worth remembering. One is turning the intransitiveness of mass media against themselves by producing a spectacle an analysis reveals the media are hungry for already. Since it isn't just that the media are producers, I think this was the basic mistake. The media are also themselves consumers. They consume sights and sounds. News, spectacle. So the consumer can be a producer of that. And so that's where I would start to qualify this, to suggest that you need to ask where the point of production is and where the point of consumption is within the media themselves, and not just assume that they are in the driver's seat or that there is some hidden force behind them that is pulling the strings. Those who are watching are also pulling some strings of some sort. That's only the beginning of an answer to a question. You couldn't hear the question?
Can you hear this one if I speak like this? Can you hear this question? That may not be worth hearing. Professor Mitchell, thank you very much indeed. I enjoyed your lecture hugely. I agree with a great deal of it. I don't necessarily agree with your characterization of something called media studies, but that's a matter for another moment. I think that a lot of what you were saying seemed to me to be as much homage to McLuhan as those whom you've criticized. It seemed to me that the metaphor and the characterization of media that you present is as his was, essentially an environmental one. And what that seems to miss is precisely what Williams opposes, even though Williams is, as you say, pushing to the point where media themselves disintegrate in social practices. What Williams is doing is saying, hold on a minute, media are something else than environments. They're also experience, and they're constructed through experience, and they're constructed through human beings' practices and work and relationships to each other, as well as their relationships to the media themselves. And that's what I missed in your account, that, as it were, the human and the dialectic of the relationship between a medium as power and as force and as something and as determining, and as even if one has a model of somebody behind, and the generalized capacity to engage, to critique, to change, to transform, which in one sense, in McLuhan's sense, is we become ourselves media too.
Could you all hear the question well enough? Yes? No? It'd be impossible for me to reproduce it. I don't know why I asked. I think the paper is an homage to McLuhan, who I think has been unjustly denigrated and almost ritually dethroned time after time, always a kind of first footnote where he's dismissed as having been wrong. That's why I began with his moment of saying, you mean my entire fallacy is wrong. And I think it's really worth going back to study McLuhan carefully now that he's safely dead. And you're also right, I think, to see that I am tending to favor the environmental concept of media as opposed to the communication, the linear sender-receiver model. Although I want it seems to me that any media theory would have to play on both. My emphasis, though, is on the question, why is it that what comes through the output end is never quite the same as the input end? And so my suggestion would be that somewhere in the... I'm now thinking of Echo's diagram of the communication model. Somewhere in there is a ghost in the machine, that the machine has a mind of its own. Or maybe the machine is a mind. As when, for instance, you just asked me a question, I'm remembering it. I might even try to repeat it to someone else, in which case I would be the medium for your question to the audience. We have a notion that some media would be transparent and the question would arrive exactly in the same form that it left the questioner and arrive at the questionee. So I think the environmental model that McLuhan offered us is always there in the wire, in the signal, in the channel. And that's why I'm trying to emphasize that. Perhaps too much. Maybe I'm exaggerating it. It strikes me as, in the context of the project I'm working on, which is why media, when we talk about them, even Luhmann must fall back on examples. He must fall back on cases. And for me, it's those cases and thinking exorbitantly about the cases that is the place where media theory might find its bearings and be less concerned with lifting itself out as Baudrillard hoped to lifting itself out of media to act on it from some position of power or force. So, again, part of an answer.
I wanted to ask you, I've been doing a lot of work on professors at the
Yes, great question, Dana. Thank you. Well, I hope that I'm in no danger of becoming a media avatar or a star media theorist. I'm just a humble art historian who stumbled into media theory a few years ago because it seemed like, you know, that's the way I work. I just kind of wander from one problem to the next. I hope there's a logic to it. But more seriously, what I think my pedagogical idea as ideal as a professor, say a professor of media studies or somebody who teaches a course called Theories of Media, is to use old and new media as creatively as possible to create a learning community. And one thing I'm quite excited about with new media, I've been experimenting a lot with a course website, and if I had been giving a pedagogical lecture here, I would have hooked us into the internet and showed you my the discussion board of my media theory class, which has been reading basically all of the texts I've been talking about, seeing these film clips, and seeing many other films as well. What I find is that the students have a great deal of expertise, often kind of uncoordinated or somewhat inchoate, and that one of the great pedagogical joys is to create a community in which they suddenly are wired together, so their face-to-face communication, which I try to encourage a lot, is augmented and accelerated by online communication, by the sharing of resources, websites, links of various kinds, and the analysis of ideas, collective analysis of ideas. One of the things this class has produced over the last 2 years is a glossary of keywords in media theory, which each student is responsible for becoming the avatar of a word. You know, one person is screen, another one is virtuality, another one materiality, another one dialectics. And it's their job to be the best possible exemplar of what the issues are with that word. So for me, the idea is to defetishize the media theorist as the know-it-all, as the Lacanian one who is supposed to know. Because obviously, I mean, if media are what we know them to be, no human mind, no single mind could capture all of them. But there is this notion that somehow they are this mystical totality, and that's why I think the great media theorist so often appears as an oracle who does not make arguments. Think about Baudrillard himself, or Friedrich Kittler, or McLuhan, who speaks basically in aphorisms. The television screen is the retina of the mind's eye. And then McLuhan's wonderful aphorism, why you mean my entire fallacy is wrong. So that I want to decenter and defetishize the media theorist, the professor, by doing this. And I guess that's in another way of saying this is I side with Woody Allen there. If only life were like this. Yeah, please do. Absolutely not. Right. I really do not want to have that happen. And I want to use the media to create face-to-face communities, and face-to-face communities to create literate, wired communities. It's some kind of interaction between those two moments. And I'm kind of excited at this moment because I think with the latest version of this course this winter, I finally succeeded. 12 of the students at the end of the quarter decided to organize themselves and create a website called the Chicago School of Media Theory, this grandiose thing. And they are planning on sticking together for a year and reading together and putting stuff out, trying to make something happen. And that to me is the most exciting moment. Not when, you know, you give a lecture and everybody applauds. That's fine. That's very nice. But the great thing is when 12 students go off and say, we don't need you anymore. We can organize ourselves.
Well, on that note, you need you. Thank you for coming.